It's the Security Weekly News, and it's episode 297. Wow, that starts to make me feel old. We're going to have to start reporting it hexadecimal or something. But it is Friday the 12th of May, 2023. We've got Singing Terminators, Gmail, Joe Sullivan, Drago, CSXI, Microsoft, Greatness, Jessica Davis, and more on this episode of the Security Weekly News.
This is a Security Weekly production for security professionals by security professionals. Please visit securityweekly.com/subscribe to subscribe to all the shows on our network.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week, your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News.
Did you know that Active Directory is exploited in 9 out of 10 cyber attacks? With access to Active Directory, attackers can gain control of your network. To keep attackers out, you need to find and fix Active Directory security gaps. Meet Purple Knight, a free security assessment tool that scans your environment for hundreds of vulnerabilities and helps you fix the problems. Ready to reduce your Active Directory attack surface? Download Purple Knight, the number one Active Directory security vulnerability assessment tool. Visit securityweekly.com/Semperis, S-E-M-P-E-R-I-S, for more information.
Hi, folks. I'm Adrian Sanabria, the host of Enterprise Security Weekly. Every week, we interview the most interesting folks we can find, talking about the most pressing cybersecurity issues and challenges facing the enterprise today. Myself and my co-hosts have each been in the industry for decades, long enough to see the patterns in the industry and explore where trends are going. In addition to enterprise challenges, we also follow the vendor space, the most interesting security startups emerging, technology and product trends, all of the most interesting funding and acquisition announcements. Finally, we love to discuss the latest trends in tech and how they'll impact cybersecurity. If you're wondering how the latest in AI, quantum computing, cloud, and DevOps is going to impact security a few years down the road, you should follow the Enterprise Security Weekly podcast.
All right, welcome to the Security Weekly News this week. I'm Doug White. Well, if you're a Gmail user in the United States, you can actually now run scans of the dark web, apparently, to see if, well, not if, but like how many times your Gmail ID appears on the dark web. Google announced this on Wednesday at their I.O. annual developer conference. The feature was originally announced back in March, but it was only available to Google One users, so they didn't make it roll it out to everybody, and I don't think it's been rolled out to everybody yet. The tool allows you to run scans to get a report about whether your personal information, including like your name, your phone number, your social security numbers, and so forth, are on dark web portals. So it's like, you know, like a threat hunting service, I guess, for individuals. You can set notifications up so that when any matching info pops up on the dark web, it'll send you, I guess, a notification in Gmail. They said the reporting tool would be available in international markets as well soon, but the feature is called Dark Web Report, and it is being rolled out to U.S. users over the next several weeks. I haven't seen it yet, so I guess they're rolling it out in the good old alphabetic discrimination way that, you know, we all know about. Yeah. So good luck, Aaron Aronson. But all right. Joe Sullivan, the former CISO of Uber. I didn't put the umlauts on there. So what am I supposed to do? Of Uber was sentenced to 3 years of probation for covering up a data breach at Uber in 2016. The charges against Sullivan were filed in August of 2020. And then a jury found them guilty in October of 2022. So prosecutors had asked for 15 months in prison. Yeah, you want to be that guy in prison that's saying, yeah, I'm being sentenced for failing to report a data breach. What are you in for? Oh, cannibalism. How nice. But prosecutors are trying to get Joe Sullivan put in prison for 15 months, but the defense said, you know, probation. And ultimately, Joe got probation and 200 hours of community service. Sullivan was a CISO at Uber between April 2015 and November 2017 and was accused of obstructing a Federal Trade Commission investigation into a data breach at Uber in 2014. Apparently, while the 2014 incident was being investigated, and Sullivan wasn't even the CISO when that happened, Sullivan found another much larger data breach that had occurred and elected not to disclose it. The larger breach actually occurred in 2016 during Joe's tenure at Uber, and it involved the theft of more than 50 million users and drivers' personal information, including all of us. So that's how all that stuff got on the dark web. But Uber paid the attackers $100,000 via their bug bounty program, and Sullivan asked the attackers to sign a non-disclosure agreement that claimed no data had been stolen. You don't want to do illegal stuff. But a year later, a new CEO was appointed, and Sullivan got fired after it was found out that they had hidden the full extent of the break-in from the new management. The attackers were caught, and that's amazing, and both pled guilty in 2019 and apparently agreed to testify against Sullivan. So Sullivan is a former federal prosecutor who directed security in Silicon Valley at eBay, PayPal, Facebook before going over to Uber, and probably should have known better, you know, but, you know, that's the way it goes. So don't do that kind of stuff. Dragos CEO Robert M. Lee said that during a ransomware attack on Dragos, you always like that, the attackers were phoning his wife and his five-year-old son in an effort to get paid. The attackers claimed on their site that they exfiltrated 130 gigabytes of data, but Dragos announced that internal systems and the Dragos platform were not impacted and that Dragos did not pay any ransom. So Lee's a big proponent of sharing information about security incidents and apparently put his approach into effect on his own company as well. And they did post a detailed account of the breach. There's a link in that article. The incident began this Monday when, quote, known criminal groups managed to access some selected Dragos systems via a personal email address compromise of a new employee prior to their start date. So they basically impersonated a new employee and completed the onboarding for the employee, and they were able to get access to some Dragos systems. So that's what happens when you use those old default passwords with those onboarding emails. They got flagged, though, and the account was blocked before they were able to do very much. So 11 hours after the initial breach, they had not been able to deploy any ransomware, but the attackers began targeting executives at Dragos with threats of information disclosure. And that included calls to Lee's five-year-old son and his wife. Lee said, quote, the criminals obviously got frustrated because we never attempted to contact them. Paying was never an option, but they continued to call me, threaten my family and the family of many of our employees by their names. So pretty nasty, but, you know, they are like criminals after all. So they're doing criminal stuff. One system I used to not really worry about, and I know it was naive, and I know you're going to look at me and go, come on, Doug, it was my hypervisor. I really felt like, you know, my hypervisor was pretty safe, and it probably was because I had it all firewalled off anyway. But I mean, I did worry about a little bit, but I felt like it was pretty reasonably secured, you know, although all those old mainframe shells were always on my mind. So apparently there is evidence now that ESXi, that's the VMware bare metal, you know, hypervisor product, is a valuable target for ransomware groups. I was kind of like, you think? But I always felt like it was pretty safe. But then, you know, we started seeing this stuff back a few years ago, and a leak of Babok source code in September 2021 provided a mechanism for attackers to attack VMware ESXi. Sentient Labs reported that they had observed a strong increase in VMware ESXi ransomware based on Babok through 2023. Sentinel Labs also said that the ESXi args campaign on VMware servers back in February was not likely Babok, despite claims from Sentinel One earlier that had said they went on and said that the only real similarity between these two attacks was they both shared some of the open source libraries that accessed various vulnerabilities. The point is, ESXi is not immune to attacks, but they're prime targets. And the prime targets in the industry are ESXi users who, I love this part, don't have solid controls in place, don't manage their versioning, and don't know what assets they actually have and whether or not their servers are outward facing. Like, you think? I mean, basically, those are people that every time you describe them, you're going, yeah, you're going to get hit. Basically, the Babok incident should just remind us that nothing is secure, and especially if you have outward-facing web interfaces and management interfaces, you should definitely be worried, because even if this vulnerability is fixed, there's probably another one. So I wouldn't assume things. You definitely don't want to use security through obscurity. I mean, even if you're running GCOS on a Honeywell 6000 series, that's probably not obscure enough. I mean, really. Yeah. Microsoft released a security update to address a secure boot zero day, which is exploited by Black Lotus UEFI malware. If you don't recall or you never knew, secure boot is, and we've talked about it a couple of times recently, it is a component that is running in your firmware. And basically what it does is it evaluates what is being loaded in the boot process. So this is before the operating system. So this is very meta. And so before that operating system gets loaded, the secure boot system can decide whether or not it should proceed. So if there's a signature problem or whatever, secure boot can say, nope, not going to load that. It's essentially protection from a boot kit. And boot kits are really hard to get rid of, right? Because they load before anything else, so they can kind of hide from you. And anything that you do or you try to get rid of, they can sort of prevent that. I mean, a desoldering kit might help. Remember that T-1000 Terminator? You remember that thing and how hard that was to get rid of? I mean, like big bucket of molten crap that you have to throw it in. And even then, it's still coming up for air every few minutes. Yeah, like that. So Microsoft released a patch that is not going to be implemented unless you implement it. It's optional. It was in the May 9 Patch Tuesday collection. They said the vulnerability would allow an attacker to execute self-signed code at the UEFI level, which is bad. I mean, and so even if you have secure boot enabled, they were still able to execute this code, which would load then a boot kit. All Windows systems have this flaw per Microsoft. But the patches don't work on all Windows devices, only on supported versions of Windows 10, 11, and Windows Server. The fix is not enabled by default at this point, but you can run MSInfo32. It's a command line instruction that'll show you if you even have secure boot running. I had somebody ask me this the other day, and they said, do we even use this? And I was like, type MSInfo32, and they were like, oh, no, it's turned off. And I'm like, yeah, so you're already vulnerable, so it doesn't even matter. But the article does have instructions for how to enable this service, how to enable this patch. And they did say a simpler version would be available in July of 2023, and hopefully they fix by first quarter of 2024, which kind of shows you how difficult these low-level flaws are to fix. It's going to take them like a year to get this actually rolled out as a part of the operating system. Greatness is a phishing as a service platform, a FASP or something. FASP, I don't know how to say that. And in a new report from Cisco Talos, apparently the usage has been spiking this year against particularly Microsoft 365 in the United States and other Western nations. The Greatness tool is basically a one-stop shop for running a phishing campaign. The attacker pays the fees, so it's got a subscription service, probably got a nice help desk, and they probably respond and don't put you on that endless hold about, we care about your call. Your wait time from this point is expected to be 36 months. Yeah, like you get from the airline. But the attacker uses a nice admin panel that's got an API key that pushes them in there. They hand over a list of email targets. The platform allocates enough infrastructure to run the campaign, including a phishing page, HTML attachments, spins up servers, very fancy. The attacker just has to write an email and put some tweaks in the defaults to make, the more tweaks you put in, apparently, the better the attack. And it goes from phishing to spear phishing to whaling or whatever. They have all those fancy terms for that stuff, but it's all just phishing. But then the service sends all the emails out with the attachment that's created. And the victim opens the attachment, obviously, and an obfuscated JavaScript executes in your local browser. And that connects to the Greatness server, and then that pulls down a phishing page. Now, the cool thing about this, or I guess the uncool thing about it since it's bad, is it automatically injects the target's company logo and background images from the employee's actual Microsoft 365 login page. So it looks really real. And here's the even creepier part. It fills in the email automatically, so obviously, since they knew what it was, and then the user types in their password. But here's the creepy part. The platform acts as a proxy between the victim and the legitimate Microsoft 365 login page. So they're basically just sitting between you, and it passes all the information along and so forth. That lets them get a cookie for you. Even if you have multi-factor, no problem. The Greatness tool will prompt the victim to input the code and then sends the request to Microsoft to send the code to that account, and then passes that information along. Wow, that's going to hurt. So Greatness does authenticate you on the real platform, and then that session cookie gets sent via Telegram or some other kind of an approach. They were using Telegram a lot, apparently. But from there, well, Bob's your uncle. I mean, once they've done all that and they've got your session cookie, they can pretty much do whatever they want to your Microsoft account. And if you're like a lot of people, you work in a company that has a lot of Microsoft stuff and it's all interlinked to this one login, yeah, that's as they say in the business, going to be bad. Well, my next guest is Jessica Davis, a senior editor for healthcare, cybersecurity, and policy at SC Media, Cyber Risk Alliance. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Not too bad. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad you could make it. So this story that you had done is called National Cybersecurity Labeling Program Expected in May for IoT Devices. And I saw the title. I was like, that's pretty interesting to me. I mean, could you just maybe give us a quick rundown on what this article is about?
So the Biden administration proposed this plan in the late fall after a meeting with the National Security Council, with some consumer product associations and device manufacturers. And it was at RSA that leaders from Intel, Samsung, and NIST Cybersecurity Program for IoT, which is leading the consumer IoT labeling program, they sort of hinted at, or also formally suggested, that the plan or the formal launch is expected sometime this month. So labels, of course, are referring to the requirements and other aspects of a security program for a specific device, obviously based on NIST criteria. And manufacturers would essentially be declaring to consumers that the product is secure. It kind of mimics the Energy Star labeling program operated by the EPA. And the energy to promote energy efficiency. The idea sort of is to start with the highest risk devices with consumer, obviously, starting soon. And this has been working to build that core baseline, and it applies across the board for all IoT devices, regardless of the market. And the aim is to sort of assure the consumers that these products are safe and incentivize providers or manufacturers, to bake security into the devices and meet these higher cybersecurity standards.
Are they going to require any kind of testing for this stuff?
I imagine that they would, but I honestly think that the idea here is to sort of create this baseline, and then as the FDA sort of typically does, they work with these manufacturers to sort of ensure that they're saying, I did this and this and this, and make sure that those security products actually do what they say they're going to do, sort of considering those when implementing, like a chip, for example, whether or not that is from, as we discussed before the program, sort of from some guy off the street, or where it's actually been verified that it's sort of secure.
Well, so in the last 5 years, I've spent a bunch more time than I wanted to in hospitals because I had all these family and friend issues, and it wasn't me, but I was there, so I wasn't the sick person. So I was looking around and, trying not to get in trouble, but I'm looking around. I see cameras, I see, Ring doorbells, I see all kinds of stuff that's been put in like hospitals and emergency rooms and nursing homes and all these rehab facilities and whatever. And I was wondering, how bad of a problem do you think this is?
It is massive. it has been something that industry leaders, there's a Dr. Hacker known as Christian DeMeff out of UCSD that has sort of been talking about the prevalence of medical devices and the lack of security measures behind them. There's a serious overuse of legacy devices in healthcare specifically. That would be astounding to anyone in any other sector. We're talking about, not even knowing either. If they know, right, they're like an MRI, for example, let's start there. Like an MRI could be, 20 years old and operating on Windows 7. They're not going to replace that because it still works. And that's millions of dollars, right? And that's just not going to happen. So at least the FDA has said that program has been, it's October 1st is the deadline, but the FDA just last month said this can't continue. So while legacy devices will still be a challenge, at least new devices moving forward, even consumer health, like IoT products, like diabetic insulin pumps and things like that, those will at least be baked with security in mind. So at least moving forward ahead of the October 1st deadline, that means that in the future we won't have these legacy devices, but they are prevalent. Most people talk about, you know, the patient monitoring devices. Those are a high risk, but actually, like, HVAC systems are one of the higher risk devices because they're not typically installed with the security team in mind. And if they don't know what's part of that system, then you could be, you know, basically giving a backdoor into a hospital network.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there's two layers of that, or actually maybe more than two layers, because I've done some audits of hospitals. And so one layer is obviously the MRIs and the X-ray machines and all this kind of equipment that's there. That's a problem. Then there's a second tier of that stuff that's like OT type stuff, like HVAC equipment. And so now we've installed actuators that turn the air conditioning on or open the vents or whatever. And all that stuff is often legacy and maybe really, really legacy. And then the third tier of that would be, actually, I'm going to do four. The third tier of that would be internal. So an employee, a doctor brings in a toy even and plugs it into the company network. And then, of course, the fourth tier of that would then be consumers themselves who are bringing devices on site, you know, maybe especially if they're doing a long-term stay. Because here's an example, twice. So once in a assisted living facility, which is not really, it's not covered by HIPAA, I don't think. But, and then the other time was it is? Okay. So then I probably broke the law. And then in a rehab, both those times I installed Wi-Fi devices and cameras so that one was for my mother, one was for my friend Lou. And you know, that way I could talk to him and nobody said a word. I took that camera and plugged it in and just put it on the Wi-Fi and we're good to go.
There is actually, I can't remember the system, not that they would ever commit to that, but there have been successful entryways created in that way where that has been a doorway in where they create their own public platform or connect their own devices that are not secure. Bring your own devices like its own challenge. And the problem, the sixth tier, if we could go that far, is the idea that there's a vast amount of health systems that just don't know that that would be insecure. So they don't have programs or verification checks for any of these things. So we still have public internet, for example. So you're sort of creating your own entry points without even knowing it because there's no sort of check into whether or not that's happening or that it's a risky thing in the first place.
Well, yeah. So I think, and you can maybe tell me if you think I'm on the right compare analogy here. When Wi-Fi first started going, I was doing a lot of audits and we were auditing things like doctor's offices, hospitals, infrastructure. And one of the things that would happen is like one of the first ones I caught a doctor who worked in a fairly large facility, not in Rhode Island, had brought a Wi-Fi router at like Best Buy or something and brought it into the office and plugged it in because the doctor was trying, they were still using paper, but the doctor wanted to use an iPad and needed a Wi-Fi network and plugged it in. And this thing was essentially a rogue access point that I was able to access from a parking garage across the street. And the only response I got from the management was, yeah, but who would know how to do that, Doug? Yeah.
No, that doesn't surprise me. Insiders especially are the Verizon annual data breach report consistently. Healthcare is always like one of the biggest breach sectors, but the biggest point of entry is insiders either inadvertently doing things like that or going around security protocols because it's easier to maintain patient care. We're in like health systems have stacked up too many security measures to keep things safe, but didn't consider clinician workflow. So that doesn't surprise me. This happens more often than not, but unless they know it happens or can find that at this point, it's not going to be reported.
Yeah. I mean, so I do think there's a lot of issues there. Like we said, you could probably keep going with the levels. You could probably go down to level 6 and level 7. I mean, even if just some kid brings in their, an iPad from home to sit there in the waiting room at the hospital while, you know, their grandfather's sick or whatever, those are that bring your own device problem is very big problem. And I've seen that in healthcare where they don't have guest networks. And I saw one, I was visiting it to see if I thought my friend should be there. And I was actually able to see their whole corporate network. I mean, I was just literally sitting there waiting with a laptop, and their Wi-Fi was interconnected to everything in the building. So if I bring a, a May doorbell that I saw this at another assisted living, they were letting the residents bring these, they could do whatever they wanted essentially. And some of the residents had these like aftermarket, you know, doorbell things that were like rings on their doors, so that, you know, when somebody pushed it, they could get it on a screen, or their family could see who was visiting them or whatever. And nobody seemed to think that was a problem.
You would be astounded at how many assisted living providers end up on the Department of Health and Human Services breach reporting tool. I mean, it's consistent, and a lot of that. And it's not like that they're flippant about it. There are, I mean, as you mentioned, there are people that are like, no one's going to do that. But there is sort of a knowledge gap and a staffing challenges where they don't really have people in these leadership roles with security backgrounds that could make those smart decisions, which has kind of been the argument against device S-bombs in the first place, for example, wherein it's like, well, they can't use this. But, you know, it's a huge complicated challenge, and something that we could talk about for probably hours if you let me.
I have no doubt. And I mean, and of course the chain on this is terrifying to me, because I know when I was doing some HIPAA audits a long time ago, you know, small doctor's offices. So now I've got a doctor's office with three people in it. They don't have any tech people or anything like that, but they were being bolted onto hospital pharmacy systems, surgical, all this stuff was all getting bolted into these little offices that sometimes were running, you know, Windows, you know, DOS with Windows 3.0 and things like that. And they're starting to try to connect these. Because one of the things I got contact with was how to connect it. This doctor I knew called me and said, could you help us connect to this hospital system? And I went over there to look at the instructions, and it's like, you know, use the dial-up modem to connect to, you know, and I was like, wow, they don't even have a login. It was just kind of like, if you knew the phone number, you could get in. And when they got in, they were in. I mean, you could see databases. You could see all kinds of stuff.
Yep, there's the same situation with PACS, which is the imaging systems. I've done a lot of work with NTT. Their researcher, Dirk Schroeder, in his free time, sort of works to sort of secure these. There's a DICOM imaging system. They directly connect the provider to the radiology system, and he quite literally just walked me into these net-like systems with patient visits, images that go with it, and it is an astounding problem. A lot of that, again, channels to resources, knowledge, and staffing, because it's just this gap. It's not like an unwillingness. It's just sort of great hygiene. The ones that are doing it really well do, but dentist's office, like my dentist told me that I would be, when he found out what I do for a living, was like, you do not want to know what kind of things that we do here. Like, we don't have a password. What are you talking about? Dentist, one of the bigger ones. I did an investigatory piece on this electronic medical record system for eye care providers. And I mean, hundreds of providers. This one EMR was hit multiple times. Months of disruptions. It's just, it happens a lot. And a lot of that stems with just sort of gaps and like not knowing, or in the case of this specific EMR, looked like some malfeasance.
And do you think this is going to grow even further when we start seeing, I would guess within the next 20 years that a vast majority of us who are not dead, like, but that are still alive, are going to start seeing more and more implanted monitoring systems, because I know people that have insulin pumps that report in. I know people have pacemakers that report in. Do you think that's going to be just a huge issue that we haven't even seen yet?
So I always tend to lean pessimistic, but in this situation, I'm more of a realist. So the FDA's recent actions that basically told manufacturers, like, get your house in order. It means that right as of now, like when a device is brought to market or attempted to be authorized by the FDA, they're already saying, nope, you're missing this. Here's how you need to fix it. And by October 1st, if they're missing these specific cyber requirements, which includes the SBOM, so like knowing what's inside of your device, even if you can't secure, you've done you know, your due diligence as a manufacturer, like that is October 1st deadline hard stop. And it will take time as they don't have enough reviewers necessarily to sort of do these requirements. It means that from October 1st, 2023, all devices come to the market. So eventually these legacy devices that are in use now that have to go through FDA will not be on the market. So I do have hope, especially in the digital health space, because we are rapidly adding these things and bolting them onto these networks that are not necessarily secure. So the problem is huge, but the FDA is really like tightening those regulations, which for the vast majority of industry stakeholders, we're all pretty excited because we've been asking for this, because it's the providers without the resources that have been sort of tasked with this from now on. So I do have hope that moving forward, we're at least doing the right things to make it safer.
But there's going to be kind of a long period of time. It's going to be sort of scary to me, because so if I went in today and they give me a pacemaker that's connected, that's horrible. It was, you know, we have no idea what its background is. And that thing's connected to a healthcare provider, and I move. So I move to Colorado and I go to a healthcare provider there and I say, well, I have a pacemaker, we need to be monitoring it. And they say, oh yeah, they're not going to tell me, oh, we can't connect you. They're going to say, yeah, we need to monitor this.
Right. There are patient safety risks, but at the moment, there is no documented situation where that has been the specific target. So if that does happen, it's been a fluke, and nor is there data to sort of support. The concern has been, and continues to be, the hypothesis of these are being used as entryways. So the device function, Christian DeMeff and his colleague, Jeff Tully, hack into these devices to sort of train clinicians on what to look for when these devices fail. So it is a little scary now, I would say. I do think it's going to be better in the future.
Well, that's great. I have one other question for you while I've got a professional writer. Yeah, this is the gotcha question you've been dreading. One space or two spaces after a full stop?
One. That is old-timey typewriter habit. I was once fired from a job at an insurer who wanted me to do forms and do the double space, because she was insistent, but that's for the typewriter, not for a computer.
I can't stop. I
know, it's an age thing. It'll pass. I'll just delete it.
I literally can't stop doing it. I mean, it is so ingrained in my brain that when I'm typing, it's dot-dot with my thumb, dot-dot with my right thumb. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm sorry, but Sister Mary Margaret and her magic cane was standing there to whack you on the wrists if you didn't do it the right way. And, you know, if you looked at your hands. I really did try to stop.
If I were hitting you, I wouldn't say anything. I would just delete it.
You just look at me disdainfully privately.
I would be like, oh, you're old.
All right. Well, thank you, Jessica, for being on. It was great. Hopefully we'll have you on again some more. I think we could talk about that for like the next day or two.
I could. As I've mentioned, it's my passion. I really think that it's important to get the awareness out. And there are people on the ground really doing the good work right now that will make a safer future.
Great.
It's scary now.
I appreciate it.
Thank you again.
And finally, okay, this is weird. It's not surprising, really, but Nicholas Stark reported that they were analyzing a Kingston SSD firmware set that was downloaded off the Kingston site. And Kingston makes all these M.2s and, you know, and SSD drives and whatever. Well, so they were looking at the zip file, which has got the binary in it, and, you know, did what a lot of us do, which is open it in a binary file. And, you know, they opened it so they could look at the actual what was in the file. And there was some plain text in it. And it appears to be the lyrics to The Scientist, a Coldplay song. The lyrics were in a version of the firmware for the M.2 drives in the KC2000 series, which makes me think they should have had the lyrics to I'm Your Boogeyman instead of The Scientist. But whatever, there's no accounting for taste. So far, Kingston has had no comment on the matter. I don't know if it's an Easter egg, it's some kind of weird AI psychosis, it's singing Terminators that are recording lyrics that they're going to sing while they come after you. Who knows? But I will be at the Millennium Alliance event in the Palmer House in Chicago next week on the 16th, 17th. If you're planning to attend, be sure and say hi. I will be at the Green Cities Conference in Augsburg, Germany in June if you're going to be around there as well. And that is the news. Aaron Leyland will be filling in for me next week. Thank you, Jessica. And I will see you when I return.